Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Does Not Compute. Before we begin this week, we'd like to thank our sponsor, which is Datadog. Datadog is a monitoring and analytics platform that seamlessly integrates your application's metrics, distributed traces, and logs all into a single unified platform for developers and DevOps teams. Datadog doesn't just collect your logs, it actually analyzes them so you can monitor your entire application's performance from end to end, database to front end to all the microservices in between. It lets you take a deep dive into the individual traces that touch every part of your application. There are these great flame graphs that let you visualize your application's performance and pinpoint specific issues, and you can even inspect right down to the code level for applications that are written in Python, Ruby, Java, Go, and Node.js. Out of the box, Datadog will even automatically detect and alert you of any weird performance behaviors that might pop up with no configuration on your part. You can build these great custom dashboards and fill them with graphs suited to your application's needs, and then you can annotate the graphs and start a discussion with your team members about what happened and how you might have fixed it. It's really easy to get started. There's over 250 turnkey integrations for things like AWS, Nginx, Kubernetes, Slack, and so much more. And installing the Datadog client on your server is really simple. It's just a one-line command, and your server instantly shows up on Datadog. So they're offering DNC listeners a free trial, and as an added bonus for signing up and creating a dashboard, they will send you a cool free Datadog t-shirt. You can start your free trial today at datadog.com/doesnotcompute, and again, they'll send you a free t-shirt.
Well, happy Black Friday.
Oh, thanks. How much money did you spend on other people, and how much money did you spend on yourself? Let's be honest here.
I bought one thing for me. Well, my business. I bought one thing for my business.
The business. Business expense. Tax write-offs on Black Friday. That's a win-win.
That's right. So, we got to lay out the story here. I don't know if I've complained about it on air. I've complained about it with you, certainly, though, about how... Okay, so... I'm in the sticks in Vermont, and I get internet that's a 100 down and 10 up. Okay, now I've argued with Charter on whether they should lift my 10 megabyte restriction, and they basically accuse me of pirating for asking to have more than 10 megabyte upload speed.
Oh, nice.
Anything you should be able to do within reason, you can do with 10 megabytes. I was like, hey man, I know what that means. Anyhow. That's the predicament we find and stuff. Okay, so 100, that's plenty fine. 10, really, I mean, realistically, that's fine too. I was doing a little streaming back when I was complaining about my upload speed. But yeah, so...
Oh, streaming like Twitch or something?
Yeah, Twitch streaming, my video games. And yeah, so I've had an Airport Extreme for almost 5 years, I want to say.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, rip. Well, I mean, it still works. But here, okay, so we're getting to this now. So... the apartment that I live in has insanely thick walls and wide doorways. So I have a pull-up bar, but it won't fit. The doors are so wide, it just won't fit the pull-up bar.
Brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. And so that gives you an idea of the construction of this place. It's newer, which I'm very thankful that I found it. And yeah, so going from my living room to my office, that's maybe 25, 30 steps. Going from my living room to my office, the Wi-Fi goes from 100 megabytes down to 20 megabytes down. Through a single wall with a door open, it drops that much. And
megabits, right?
Megabits, yes.
Sorry, just saving you some ads.
Yeah, it's fine.
But yeah, so your signal strength is totally shot. Like you're basically in a lead bunker, sounds like.
Yeah. Okay, so like 30 is, you know, pretty okay, but there's so many moving pieces here. So I have a 13-inch MacBook Pro. It only has the ports on the left side. And my monitor sits in the middle of my desk. And so I have a USB-C hub, but the USB-C cord isn't super long. So in order for me to plug the USB-C cord with my laptop open facing me, the laptop has to sit in front of the monitor, which is not okay, right? And so I say that because, yeah, the speed 30 is workable. It's fine when I have my laptop open. But the laptop has to be open in front of my monitor. So what I used to do was just leave it open, but bend it down. So literally the second screen is unusable, but it's still using power and all that stuff. Okay, so that's a frustration, maybe my minor nitpick, but that's one of my frustrations.
Not ideal.
Right. Certainly not ideal. And okay, so if I close it, the Wi-Fi drops like much, much worse because I think the aluminum shell of the laptop is just reflecting signal. Right.
Well, so here's the thing about the antenna on the MacBook Pro. It's actually embedded in the glass bezel surrounding the monitor.
Sure.
So, yeah, if you're in clamshell mode and your Luna MacBook is basically a Faraday cage. So
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as you close that, that's going to impact your signal strength for sure.
Right. Yeah. And maybe like the amount of resources that having the Retina screen open. Here's another part of the equation. Okay, so it's a 2016 MacBook Pro. It's a dual core. It runs mostly okay, but over the course of the day, it just grinds to a halt with like through Docker, through VS Code. I've actually seen substantial better performance throughout the day in JetBrains apps than I do VS Code, which is hilarious to me. And so there's, you know, so I'm like, okay, well, I'm trying to cut as many corners as I can. Well, let's put this thing in clamshell so the computer doesn't have to worry about processing that external display at all. So when I do that, my signal drops, right? And I get real slow internet. I'm talking like 5-6 megabytes down.
And at that point, like, you're already, you know, paying hand over fist for Charter internet that...
Exactly.
We have that here, and... Yeah, it's almost not even worth it at times, to be honest.
Yep. So what I did was I got a TP-Link set up. So basically, it's like Ethernet. It's like sending your internet signal through the outlets in your house.
Oh God, no! Why?
Hey, it got me back up to 20. So I get these. I'm like, yeah, they're rated for a gigabit connection. This is gonna be awesome. Nope, 20. We're back up to 20 again. But here's the thing. Occasionally, or actually more so recently, more than occasionally, when I would plug my laptop into work, I'd get a self-assigned IP address when I'm using my Ethernet adapter. So I can't even use that half the time. I have to restart my whole computer, and sometimes that doesn't work. I have to do it a couple of times, so it's just a headache, right? And when you're in the middle of work, that's the last thing you want to think about is having to restart your computer multiple times. So again, I realize these are just me whining and nitpicking about stuff, but... Over the course of 3 years, it really grinds my gears. So getting back to Black Friday, what I did was I was looking at, so where Jamie and I are moving, we're moving in December back to California, and where we're moving, we're going to be living in a house, and the Wi-Fi signal there, I visited a few times, isn't great. So we're like, oh, if we're going to get something to replace what we have now, we should probably get something that would work there as well. So what I ended up doing was going with a mesh routing system, which I had never had before. So I looked up some reviews and we picked out the Netgear Orbi. And so far, it's been awesome. So I'm sitting here, my laptop's in clamshell mode, and I'm getting 115 down, in fact. So it squeezed out an additional 15 megabytes that I don't pay for.
I mean, that's certainly improvement. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty great. So I plugged it in, I scanned a QR code, and installed an app on my phone. I scanned another QR code, and then it set everything up. So I plugged the base station in. It came with one satellite. So the satellite's in my office. The base station's in the living room. So I scanned the QR code. It linked them together, set everything up. I said, name it this. Here's the password. 10 minutes later, after a firmware update, I'm off to the races. So I unplugged the TP link set up in my office. I plugged my PC tower straight into the satellite via Ethernet and just works. No self-assigned IP address problems, nothing. I'm getting full speed in the office. So
wait. So what you're telling me is that you unironically, voluntarily scanned not one, but two QR codes?
I did. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So you open the manual. And, well, you don't even have to open it. On the front page of it, it's like, hey, we have an app that'll do this for you. Just, you know, install it. And here's a QR code. And I already have my phone in my hand. So I did that. And if you open the camera app on an iPhone, I'm sure most people know this, but if you open the camera app on an iPhone and you point at a QR code, it'll give you a push notification, and you tap on that, and it takes you to wherever the QR code wants you to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. I've heard really good things about the Orbis. I think my mom has it, and like she's had good luck with it. You know, like it's pretty much as easy to set up as you say it is, and I'm glad you're getting the actual advertised speeds that you're paying for. So that's awesome.
I know, right? For the next 3 weeks that I'm going to be here.
Half of me, like, I love messing with the Ubiquiti gear. If you've ever played with that or seen that.
I have not actually.
It's really, really awesome. It's like It's like high grade, like prosumer grade network gear that's like cheap, like next to nothing, but like real honest to God routers that you have full control over. And it's really, really awesome. Like I actually have my downstairs office set up on two totally separate LANs. Like a 10.0 address is all my home stuff and the Wi-Fi and shared and everything. And then my, I've got a Windows box and my, you know, remote ham radio station that's on a 10.1 subnet. And they both, you know, you set up the routing rules and you, you know, they share the same internet and different DHCP pools and all that stuff. So I kind of keep it separate. And like, you can get so granular, you know, they're real, again, real networking routers, like, but they're so cheap. And the Wi-Fi, they have power over Ethernet, you know, Wi-Fi hotspots and everything.
Sure.
And so half of me wants to be like, oh, you know, run the Ethernet through the house and set up this true, like, honest to God, cool professional network. And then half of me is like, oh, in 6 months when I have to like open a port on the firewall and have to remember how to do that.
right.
Like sometimes you just want that stuff to just work. So
their stuff looks nice.
It's really nice. And again, it's insanely affordable for what you get. They have this cool cloud management thing where you can, like if you have switches and network stuff all over, you can just remotely manage it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful. Yeah.
You can even get your access point skinned with a nice little wrap if you want like a white marble look.
Oh.
Yeah, this is interesting. I did like the Airport Extreme a lot. It served me well. It's just was killing me the last 3 years, I guess. I'm trying to remember even when I first moved here if it was the same way. I feel like it was probably similar. I just didn't care enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So really, like, I think what compounded it was my laptop troubles over the past. I haven't really talked about this on the show either, but it's been, how many weeks have I been like complaining to you about it in Discord?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's been several weeks. I've lost track.
Yeah. I apologize. So I didn't get this on Black Friday, but I did in fact get a new 2018 MacBook Pro.
Congratulations. What outfit did you get?
15-inch, which is the first 15-inch laptop I've ever bought.
That's awesome. Is it a beast? As much of a beast as you thought it would be?
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. Like, okay, so I have all these screenshots I'm not going to go fish through Discord and get because I don't know if anyone would find them interesting enough, but I use an app called iStat Menu. I think that's what it's called. So my menu bar basically just has a bunch of graphs and things like that. And it just like at a glance, I can see like what my CPUs are doing, what my memory is doing, temperature and all that stuff. And so over the last few months, I've noticed that things just have been feeling sluggish on my computer. And I hadn't really installed any new like software. I hadn't like added any new things to my dev setup. I just noticed that. Even like I use spaces, right? So I have four spaces, and I noticed like even swiping between spaces was kind of janky. It wasn't like a smooth transition anymore. And it just kind of kept kept building up on me. And so I started using iStat menus and I started watching how many times a day my CPU spiked. And it was like all the time. I showed you a couple of screenshots where it just showed like the last hour where I was working on the client and the API at the same time. And it was pretty, pretty bad.
Yeah. John Siracusa from the Accidental Tech podcast, he coined the phrase empathy for the machine. And you're not being very empathetic over there.
Well, I pay it to do things, or I paid for it so that it does things quickly and efficiently. And I could see, having empathy for the machine. But wow, it was frustrating. It was so frustrating. And there were other things that were happening too. So like occasionally with the client, something will happen. So like if I cause it to crash somehow, if I do that enough times, it actually, the node will dump. It'll completely just like flip upside down and crash with a memory error. And that was happening repeatedly, which hasn't really happened since I upgraded my computer, which I thought was very interesting. So yeah, anyway, there's just like a number of things. Things are compiling slower. Like you'd mentioned, if you're compiling Elixir and things take over, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds, you'll get kind of a warning in the console. It'll say like X module is taking more than 15 seconds. And I was started noticing that I would just see like just that would just flood my terminal when I'm compiling stuff, when I'm, you know, like when I write a new task and I save it and I rerun it, things have to recompile. And I would just see that taking more than 15 seconds, taking more than 15 seconds.
Yeah. I get that on my I think I have a 2013 or 14 MacBook Pro. Every time I compile or, you know, anything changes in Phoenix, I get those warnings. So, and now you jumped up from 2 cores to 6 cores. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So like, that's awesome for Elixir and the Beam in general. Cause like, that's just free performance. Like that everything you do now on your box just scales to that, which is, you know, for free basically, which is cool.
Yeah. So, practically looking at this, running my full test suite for Design Collective right now, we're at roughly 750 tests. The whole test suite on my 2016 MacBook Pro would take a minute, 15 minute, 20 seconds, which really, you know, compared to some other test suites I've worked on, 5-6 minutes in the past.
Now, most of your tests are IO bound in the sense that they're just reading and writing from the database, right? You don't have a lot of like number crunching and stuff. So
that's right. Yeah. So most of that latency is coming from the IO,
right?
And especially because I'm running PG and Docker, so it's a containerized version of Postgres. So the tests are, you know, I'm thinking in Elixir, people are like, oh, I'm running all these tests in like 10 seconds. Like, yeah, well, you know, all of my tests are setting up and tearing down the DB in writing stuff, and it's in a container. But, you know, like that's not bad. But I run them now on my new laptop and it's like 40 seconds.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, and there's like you said, there's probably a lot I can do to knock that down. I just haven't had time to do any of that. That's actually, I have a note going. Actually, it's a Notion database. And it's just notes I keep for refactoring opportunities in our app. So whenever I have an idea, I just dump it in there and then write notes down later. And that's one of them, is our testing setup, how we're being super greedy and writing and just like inserting all the time, because we're using Ex Machina and you can build. So basically you can build structs in memory and test that, which means you wouldn't have to write to the DB and tear that down after the test is done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could get some big gains for that.
Exactly. But we're just using insert everywhere because it's easier. And I mean, 750 tests in 40 seconds ain't bad, so...
Yeah, you can't really complain, especially because how often are you really running every test? You're almost never doing that, right?
Yeah.
You're usually just running MixWatch or one of those things where it really runs the dirty tests.
Yeah, you can run Mix Test.watch, it's called.
That's not first party, yeah.
Right, yeah, that's a good point. That's a third party library.
It's very, very cool, though. Should be built in, to be honest.
So what I usually do is Mix Test.watch --stale. And
that's what it is, stale, yeah.
Yeah, Test.watch will, it'll just forward any arguments, you send it straight to the XUnit is what it's called. Yeah, so mixed test basically. Yeah, so and stale will it'll just run any test that is tangential to the code, anything that's changed since the last test run. So sometimes you can make a change in code and run a stale test and it'll run 500, and sometimes it'll run 2, just depending on what you've been doing. But that's typically what I do. So yeah, it's not like I sit there for 40 seconds for every change that I make. But if you take that kind of time savings, and I'm running tests hundreds of times a day and thousands of times a week, that really adds up. But really, I think it was more so mental stuff, to be completely honest. Like, and again, these are pretty like nitpicky complaints, but like 100 times a day I'm swiping between spaces, and 100 times I see screen tearing. And so that's like 100 times a mental note of like, oh, the screen's tearing right now. Maybe I should restart my laptop because that'll fix it. You know, so that's 100 times a day me thinking, maybe I should restart my laptop. No, I don't want to have to restart all my servers, and I want to have to like, you know, spin everything back up. So I think that's really kind of what pushed me over the edge. And, you know, we've talked about using Ubuntu, and that's fine. Ubuntu was working great for me for a while until I suddenly just started getting kernel panics and crashes out of nowhere. So that was awesome. So I stopped using Ubuntu, went back to my laptop. I went over to Windows for a while, and it's passable between like WSL or the Windows subsystem. It's, you know, if that's the only thing you had access to, you could make it work. You could have a working setup, but there were all the sorts of like, you know, small paper cuts that would kind of add up over time on Windows. And so that would push me back to my laptop. So I don't know, it's probably 2 months where I was like testing out Linux, testing out Ubuntu, just testing stuff out. And I would always, after a few weeks, I would always end up back on my MacBook Pro. Always. No matter, like, my tower is certainly faster. I have a quad core CPU in my tower, you know, so that's certainly faster than my laptop, but I was always ending back up on my laptop because Mac OS.
Sure.
So that's where we're at. I've just bit the bullet and bought a new laptop.
Again with the business expenses.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's great. That's cool. And you got the space gray.
I did, yeah. Oh, a touch bar. Touch bar's new.
Oh, yeah, touch bar, which you were sending me touch bar screenshots, which I was not aware you could do. What's the keyboard shortcut for that again?
Oh, shoot. It's Command Shift Control 6.
Okay. Not that I have anything with touch bar, but I thought it was cool. You sent me a few of these screenshots before I realized, hey,
right?
How are you sending me touch bar screenshots? That's cool.
Yep.
And you've got that. You've got a pretty cool setup over there.
Yeah, so I use Better Touch Tool for that. I did not use the touch bar at all, really, before I installed Better Touch Tool. So I've been using BTT for quite a while. Traditionally, what I did was I mapped Alt-1 through 9 to apps that I use all the time. So Alt-1 might be VS Code, Alt-2 might be iTerm, Alt-3 might be Git Tower. I don't Alt-Tab as much. I just push Alt-1 ever number. That is. And so that's what I used Better Touch Tool for. And I stopped using that for a while because I've been using Alfred. And so instead of Alt-1, I'll just hit Alt-space and I'll type C-O and hit Enter, or Alt-space G-C and hit Enter to go to Code and Chrome respectively. But so I had a lifetime license for Better Touch Tool. And Paul had mentioned to me that you can actually customize the touch bar with it. So I checked it out, and you totally can. So you can even turn off the built-in system setup for touch bar altogether and only ever show your Better Touch Tool configured setup.
That's awesome. And so the screenshot you're looking at, it basically looks like a dock. You've got the escape key, rest in peace, and then you have all your applications, Chrome, VS Code, what is that, Tower?
Yes, yep, Tower.
Terminal, Discord, the most important one. FileMaker Pro, Trello.
FileMaker Pro.
But it's cool because, like, in theory, if you're on on your 15-inch, I guess you don't have such a problem with screen real estate. But
sure,
it would be nice if I was on my MacBook and I could just hide the dock and just have my, you know, handful of applications in the touch bar. That would actually make me want to use it, you know?
Yeah, I do actually. So what's cool is that you can do anything. So they have a bunch of built-in widgets that you can use. So for example, on the right-hand side, I have currently playing Spotify track. And so I can tap on that to play and pause. And I have a next and previous button. And then to the left of that, I have the current weather. Yeah, I use the touch bar a lot because of... it's set up how I want it to be set up. So the main thing that I didn't like about the touch bar before was that I would have to say I'm in VS Code and I want to turn the brightness down. I would have to tap on an icon and then drag a slider. So that's a minimum of two interactions, right?
I think you don't have to do that. I think you can just tap and slide, but I understand what you're saying, that it's modal in the sense that, like, because the touch bar is limited in space, you have to kind of go into and out of whatever mode you're using it for.
It is modal. And so with BTT, you can actually add custom gestures. So if I two-finger slide on the touch bar anywhere, it increases or decreases my volume. And if I three-finger slide anywhere, it increases and decreases the screen brightness.
Ah, that's cool.
Yeah. So with Better Touch Tool, you can on your trackpad, you can do all sorts of different non-first party, I don't know what else to call it, gestures. So there's one called a tip tap, which is pretty cool. So it's like you put your right finger down and you swipe up with your left finger. It's like a tip tap up, and you can tip tap down, tip tap left, tip tap right, for example. So you can come up with all these like different gestures for doing very fine grained things. So I used to watch Paul use his computer, and he used his thumb and his index finger, and he would, like, imagine you're tracing the outline of a circle with your thumb and your finger. So they're both moving clockwise at the same time. For him, that's moving left, or that's moving right a tab. And if you go counterclockwise, that focuses the next tab to the left.
Huh.
So like if you have two tabs open in Chrome and you're on the right-hand one, you go to left-hand one, you would spin your fingers in a circle counterclockwise and it would flip the tab for you. And so I saw him doing that one day. I was like, what are you doing? Because he was just flying around his computer. He's like, oh, it's a Better Touch Tool.
He looked like a computer wizard.
He was hardly moving his hand and his computer was doing all this stuff. But yeah, so that's a Better Touch Tool and you can completely customize it. I mean, you can even, like, you can add a button that will just run Apple AppleScript or anything you want, really. So you can make it do anything you want. You can add your own icons. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah, I use it on, I only have a few set up on my Magic Mouse that I use on my desktop. I have three fingers swipe down. You kind of like just paw at the mouse, and that activates mission control, you know, where it pops up all the windows.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really handy. And then I have, well, I have Hot Corner set up, but that's a macOS thing. Mm-hmm. And then on the, I think on the trackpad on the MacBook, I have a similar thing where you kind of use three or four fingers to activate the mish control, because I just use that a lot
right
when I'm feeling lazy and not feeling like command tabbing.
Yeah, it's been pretty okay. Like I use the touch bar mostly for music and weather stuff because it's been wild here. I witnessed my first snow squall. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yep.
I mean, I grew up in Minnesota, right? I've never heard that term before. And then my touch bar was like snow squall, because I have what's it called, dark sky widget. And I was like, what's that? I should probably walk home. And then boom, you know, there's a snowstorm.
It actually said snow squall on the touch bar.
Snow squall warning or something like that.
That's great. Yeah. That's great.
Like, my computer says I should get out of here because I was at the coffee shop. But yeah, so I use it, but I didn't really use it. I think it was just too much. Like, it was modal. I think like some people think about Vim in a similar way. Like, there's just so much stuff happening or to know about. There's layers. You have to go through layers to do things. And I didn't like that. And so what I did was I just made a simplified version that I like, and that's what I use.
That's great. And not having it change between applications, right, which is the default thing that it does. It's cool the first couple of times you see it, like, oh, I go into Terminal and like it shows me man pages and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And that seems cool the first time you do it, but then you realize, like, you never know, like, when you're taking your eye off the screen, you've already committed. Like, you've already taken your attention and your focus away from your main screen to look somewhere else.
Sure.
And it's like, if you look somewhere else and it's not what you're expecting to see, you're just like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, I'm already distracted, and now I have to figure out where I am on the touch bar. I think that's a big downside.
Yeah.
And it's cool that you can customize it and kind of set it and forget it, seems like.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it is. And I mean, you can do like per app settings, so you can have like a custom per app touch bar. So if you want one specifically for Chrome, you could do that. I just use the global one. But you know, another thing is the escape button. I guess I just don't care enough to like care about it, but it is kind of weird that there's not a button. So it feels like, have you ever
yeah, and you're a Vim guy, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I use Control C for any escaping in Vim, so it wasn't really even like a transition for me.
Oh, okay.
Which was nice. Shout out to Greg for teaching me that, because before I'd always map KJ to escape. So I would just roll across KJ and it would escape out of whatever mode I was in.
Oh.
Yeah. And Control C is just naturally in Vim. So that's just one extra thing I could. I'm all about removing customizations from my setup these days. Ignoring the last 10 minutes where I just talked about changing the touch bar. I guess really what I'm all about is simplifying things. And yeah, Control C allowed me to do that. But it's weird, like if you ever stepped off of your doorstep and what looks like solid snow is a thin layer of snow over ice and your foot moves and you don't want it to and you weren't expecting it to. Has that ever happened to you?
I mean, I grew up here.
Yeah, so I guess it has. That's what it's like to me. So I go to reach for the escape with my pinky. My pinky just keeps sliding across the touch bar. Like, that's weird, but it still triggers something, you know? It's still triggering the escape.
It's weird, yeah, because you can just like barely brush it. Like, you can, even though you're missing it, because the problem with the touch bar is that it doesn't go all the way to the left. The screen doesn't go all the way to the left side of the black area. There's a bezel,
yes,
for lack of a better word. And yeah, the escape key is not where you expect it, but it will still trigger even if you don't put your finger on it. So they obviously recognize that you're gonna aim for it.
So why is that? Because I know on the right hand side there's Touch ID, but why doesn't it go? Is it like purely a symmetry thing that it doesn't go to the left? That drives me insane.
It's gotta be the long reach of Johnny Ive.
Oh, I don't like that, because it does irk me a little bit when I see it. I'm looking at it right now, and it's driving me crazy.
It's all right. You can just send that MacBook Pro over here. That's bothering you. I'll take care of it for you. You don't have to worry about it.
So I'm really hoping that this lasts me the next 5 years. Hoping. That's what I'm hoping. Because what kind of like spurred me to actually get a 15-inch laptop and spend probably a little bit more money than I wanted to or was maybe comfortable, even though it was a business expense, was that you have a MacBook Pro that's still kicking and still viable and it works. And it was like 4 or 5 years old, right?
Yeah, I think it's a 2013 Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's what I'm shooting for. And I've always gotten these 13-inch MacBook Pros that were kind of like mid-tier. And granted, yes, I could keep doing my work on it, but it's more of like a small paper cut, kind of like small frustrations that add up kind of thing. And that's what I was trying to get rid of. Now, obviously, as time goes on, those things will happen to this machine. But I think the time frame in which that would happen for a dual-core machine when I bought it in 2016 versus a six-core machine when I'm buying it in 2018, I think is probably I think I have a longer I will get a longer shelf life out of this thing than a mid-tier, you know, 2018 MacBook Pro.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. And before I like had a true home office, when I was kind of moving around a lot and just kind of working basically on the couch, right? Like my laptop choice mattered a lot more because I liked being mobile. I liked having one development computer, which I still do. Still prefer that if I can get away with it. But now that I have like a dedicated space and I've got, you know, the iMac that's always on and, you know, always running backups and running, you know, Plex and just everything, I could just leave it on all the time, right? That is where I come to do work. And so the MacBook for me is more of like, okay, I just need something with me in case I need to, right? I need to, if in case I'm traveling, I want to have something with me in case, you know, things hit the fan, in case I need to get a little bit of work done. Like, I still want the power and performance, but like, I don't need, you know, 27-inch display. I mean, before I even, there was a period where I was literally doing all the development for RHR on an 11-inch MacBook Air.
Right.
11-inch, which was awesome because like it actually fit on an airplane tray shelf. It fit nice in your lap, you know, legs crossed on the couch. Like, I just brought that thing everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, non-retina screen, 11-inch, it was tiny. And I got so much done on that. It was really awesome. In fact, the past couple of weeks, I've had trouble sort of focusing just kind of in my office. And I'll just literally, and it's much nicer upstairs, you know, living room, lots of good morning sun and whatever. So it just makes me feel better, especially in the winter when it's usually like gloomy and cold and whatever. So I'll just sit up on the couch with a MacBook and just do work, even though I've got a computer downstairs that's twice as powerful and
right. Seven
times the screen real estate, right? It's really weird. And I don't know, having the smaller screen sort of forces you to focus and not get distracted and have Discord and Slack and Terminal and Notion and 17 Chrome tabs. Like, it really helps me just kind of get tunnel vision and get work done. I'm trying to do that a little bit more.
So I thought about getting a Mac Mini. I really considered that.
Yeah, because they're the new update's pretty awesome. They're pretty legit now.
Yeah, so I really considered it. But it's kind of like what you were saying. I get really restless, especially I think here in Vermont, especially in the wintertime, because walking anywhere consists of, I don't have a car, so walking anywhere consists of trudging through the snow. And it gets windy here in the wintertime as well, for whatever reason. So I'm trudging through wind and snow to go wherever to feel not enclosed in a coffin that is my office, because I'm here 7 days a week. You know what I mean? So that's really why I keep buying laptops, I think, is because I get really restless if I have to be in an office. And I don't know if part of this, so like thinking back at Octopus, I had to be, you know, I wasn't working remotely there. I had to go in office, but I think part of it was that like I was leaving home and I was riding my bike or skateboarding to the office every day. And then over lunch, I would go outside and ride my bike or skateboard and then I would come back. So I think that helped. But maybe that's why I've been struggling in Vermont a little bit, is because it's harder for me to do that here than it was where I lived in Santa Cruz, because the ocean was close. I could ride my bike anywhere. People were conscious of it. There were actual sidewalks or bike lanes. You know what I mean? It was just a different place, So I'm excited to be, I don't know if I've actually said officially when I'm moving back, but I'm moving back to the West Coast in December, mid-December. So I'm pretty excited for that aspect of it, to be outdoors again and or more often and not have to deal with the snow. Feeling pretty happy about that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm excited for you.
Yeah. But so that's what I did. I didn't buy the laptop on Black Friday. I bought it a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't show anybody right away because I was a little ashamed for whatever reason. I don't know why, but I was, you know, I didn't. Yeah. I've been struggling. It was normally like getting a Mac for me was like a happy, like a joyous experience. Like, oh yeah, I'm getting a new Mac. That's awesome. But this time around, it felt like the least worst thing I could do to upgrade my business setup.
That's good. So what are your plans for the 2016? Is that going to be Jamie's? Are you going to just sell it or?
Thought about selling it. Not sure. I wiped it. So it's got a fresh install.
Nice.
I probably will sell it. I don't really need it. It's in good condition. It's still a good machine. It's just that if you're running a Node app and an Elixir app and Docker and however many Electron apps we all have to run these days, it starts to break down a little bit.
You should run a Minecraft server on it. Do people still do that?
Probably could. I don't know.
So actually, I came across a new piece of Apple equipment as well.
Oh, really?
Well, new to me, I should say. My mother is actually more of a tech geek than I am, or like either of us combined. And so she always gets the latest and greatest, and I get the, you know, hand-me-downs, which most of the time are pretty nice hand-me-downs. So I bought her old iPad Pro, which in the keyboard and the pencil, all that stuff, which, you know, is now ancient history as far as technology is concerned, but it's it's still pretty awesome. And I've never had, the first iPad Classic, I guess, which is still kicking around here somewhere, but has long since, you know, been retired because, you know, I don't think you can update it past iOS 8.
Right.
So,
what are we on, 12 now?
Yes. 12. Yeah. 12.1. So, yeah, it was nice having a new iPad for once, just for as a, you know, consumption device, just sitting around YouTube and Reddit and, you know, whatever, email and stuff, and having the keyboard, like having the real honest to God keyboard makes me like realize how close and how awesome the iPad could be if it just had better, you know, professional software support.
Yeah, it.
I mean, lots of people go into this kind of ad nauseum. I don't want to harp on it, but oh man, the keyboard shortcuts, everything like works just pretty much as you expect. You know, command tabbing brings up a little app switcher. If you hold the command key for a couple seconds, it actually pops up a little bezel, like a little window that shows you what the keyboard shortcuts are right now in the app you're using, which is really handy, right?
Yeah.
For kind of discovery purposes. The multitasking stuff has worked pretty great. Like once you figure out exactly like, oh, which windows can slide over, which ones can be side by side, how does it remember the state of the windows in terms of like, you know, which windows are paired with that,
yeah,
and all that stuff. So that was cool. And I've had a lot of fun playing with it. I primarily got it for ForeFlight, which is a flight planning application for my private pilot's training that I've been doing. Anyway, the point was I tried to set it up for development, for software development. I'm like, okay, I've got a keyboard. The App Store is gigantic. There's got to be a good editor.
Yeah.
And there are good editors. So I tried Textastic, I think it was called.
Oh, that's a throwback. Yeah. I used to try to use that at one point in time.
Yeah. And it's great. Like, it's a good editor. But then I was like, okay, well, I don't just need an editor. I need version control. I need to be able to run my code. I need a terminal, which Textastic has built in and seemed good enough. But, you know, it's just another requirement. I don't need linting, but I need the mixed auto formatter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I would need multi input support in terms of like having multiple cursors, because
right,
once you use Sublime Text and multiple edit points, everything else seems broken.
Yep. Agreed.
And so all these things start to pile on. I'm like, oh, like I tried a bunch of tools. I'm not going to be able to recreate my development environment as I want it. And like, okay, I can't run any arbitrary code locally because of App Store restrictions. I'm not going to be able to install the Beam and run Elixir locally,
mm-hmm,
or JavaScript or Node or anything. But I'm like, okay, that's fine. I have internet access 99.9% of the time. I'll just, you know, remote in or use SSHFS or SFTP or one of those things to just do my work remotely and terminal in remotely, do my work remotely. Fine, as long as I have like a native, you know, editor and just use the browser or whatever.
Right.
But even that like was not, it did not feel productive at all. And not just because the tools are different. It was just like I started to realize all these other requirements that are piled on that were just not going to make that feasible. So I was a little kind of bummed out by that. I was kind of surprised, to be honest, the lack of variety of apps that you do this.
Yeah. So I think it was Dan Eden. I think his name was Dan Eden. I'm pretty sure he's a designer at Apple now. But yeah, so back in the day, he had a blog I used to read. And back in the day, I mean, like, I don't know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, maybe, yeah, probably 6 years ago. And he was kind of trying to do the same thing back then. He was like, can I be a designer and a front-end developer with an iPad? And basically, he came to the same conclusion, like, it was close, but just not quite there. And it's interesting, what, 6 years later? It's like, the answer is kind of the same, right?
Yeah.
Because you can get, like, yeah, you can make it possibly work, but that's not it's not a great experience.
Yeah, and not being a good experience is enough of a reason for it not to be your main way to get work done. Because, like, you can wave your hands, be like, oh, you know, editing my kids' photos or whatever, it's not the best experience, or, you know, email's not the best experience. Like, you can get around some of those things. But when it's the tools you use to get your job done, mm-hmm. like, you know, you're a craftsman, you're not going to use some, like, crappy old plane to, like, make some wood flat. Like, you're going to, you know, have a nice, sharp tool that's custom built for the job, that is like a professional tool that you pay for and you know it's exactly what you need.
Right.
You're not going to like compromise on your tools because it's just, you know, wasting time and mental energy. And yeah, just really, really hit home how close iOS is to just breaking that barrier and being like a really productive tool for me. I mean, I played with Lightroom.
Mm-hmm.
I have done a lot of photography in the past, not so much recently. But like, I played with Lightroom, like, oh, I could actually like legitimately use this iPad version of Lightroom to do all of my photography work, you know, going through the photos and doing the editing I need and stuff. Like, it's pretty much there. Maybe not as a professional, but as a, you know, amateur who, you know, likes the tools to, you know, have a professional quality photos or whatever.
Yeah.
I was like, oh yeah, I could totally see this working. But as a programmer, it's just, I don't know, not there. And I think you said that Paul has gone through the same saga as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, so we've tried different things. He's probably gone a little bit farther into it than I have. But like the last thing that I tried for having, so basically like the dream is to have a dev environment that you can just access. I guess it's like an online dev environment, right? So you kind of like can log into it from whatever device, whether it's an iPad, MacBook Pro, Chromebook, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of like what you're really after?
So that's kind of the next logical step. I mean, I think the best experience is having native support. And by native, I mean, you know, actual GUIs running on your, in your native frameworks built for your device.
Right.
I think that's really the best possible outcome. Is it the most likely to happen? Maybe not.
Sure.
I know like Amazon has a cloud-based hosting. I think it's called Cloud9.
Yep. It is Cloud9.
Yeah, yep. AWS Cloud9. Have you played with that?
Not since Amazon bought it.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah. It's, yeah, I played with it for 5 minutes. And again, it was cool, but it's like, again, you realize like all the other little tools and customizations that you've done locally, you're just not going to be able to get to work there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There was another one called Coding. I think they've since gone, it used to be like a paid service, and it was similar to Cloud9, only a little bit more intense. I'm trying to remember exactly. So they would try to like, yeah, you had an online ID and everything like that, but also it was like container based, right? So if you hired a new person and you had a container orchestration set up, they could basically have a working machine in 5 minutes with like the exact build tools, with the, you know, exact everything was there. I tried that a little bit, and yeah, it gets close, but it's just not the same. So I don't know that my need is there enough, or maybe I'm just too comfortable with my tools, but it's always so close but so far away at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the dream is being able to bring the iPad somewhere and get work done.
Okay.
Having the iPad as a backup is kind of like a secondary goal, whereas like if I'm going somewhere, maybe if I'm going, not going on a trip, but like I'm leaving the house, now I can just bring the iPad and I know I have like a terminal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I can go on AWS and I can like reboot things, like worst case scenario, the world is ending. I can fix things.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually need has sort of been fulfilled. Like I feel comfortable doing that, right? Give me a terminal. That's great. And a real keyboard. Although no escape key.
Man, you're killing me.
No, the iPad Pro keyboard doesn't have an escape key.
I know. They're all going away.
Yeah.
They're all going
Although,
away.
Although the terminal that's built into the editor that I ended up using, I'll put in link in the show notes. I forget the name right now. Mapped command tilde key, or like command backtick, you know, the one that's where the escape key should be.
Mm-hmm.
They mapped that to the escape key, like for the terminal. And that was like surprisingly easy for me to rewire my brain to do.
Yeah.
So I'll save you some trouble for trying to figure all that stuff out. In terms of state of the art, it's just not there yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so one thing that Paul and I tried at the same time actually was we just tried getting a DO box and just SSH into that every day and work.
Sure. Sure. That makes sense. Cause like who cares how powerful your computer is when you've got, you know, an infinitely scalable thing in the cloud. Right.
Right. And so what killed that was just intermittent network changes. So, you know, things just getting dropped or like latency when typing. That was the big one for me. And again, it's, if you really think about it, it's pretty minor nitpick, but you'd be typing and.
And you can get around that if you can use, if you ever use Mosh, which I've never used.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of it.
But Mosh is a remote terminal that's designed to support intermittent bad connections. But the problem is, you have to run a special server and a special client. You can't just use an SSH client, right? It's a special client. So like you couldn't just use it. You'd have to use something that supported Mosh.
Right. But that was kind of what killed it was that just kind of things happening here and there, things drop, like the connection dropping or just, it wasn't like typing into the computer in front of me where there's no latency.
Mm-hmm.
It was just not what I was used to, I think, and that was kind of what killed it for me. I was fine, like Vim was great, all that was that was all fine. It just wasn't quite the same.
Someday.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting closer. I still think that it's going to be GitHub. Personally, I think that VS Code will just be in the cloud in GitHub, and you'll just be making commits directly onto a repository, and you'll be deploying your apps with Actions, GitHub's new Actions.
Oh. Link me to that in the show notes because I don't know about this.
Oh, maybe this will have to be our clickbait to the next episode.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, so it's a new feature, just TLDR. It's a new feature. I'm trying to think of something I've used before that's similar. It's just basically a deploy flow, or they just call them actions because you can do more than just deploying your apps. But yeah, so like on an event, you can have GitHub trigger something, whether it's build a container, whether it's, you know, provision a DB somewhere else, whether it's send out a, their example is like notify people via Twilio numbers or something, you know. So it's basically just a Rube Goldberg machine that's built into GitHub.
Interesting. And like, in my head, I'm thinking webhooks, but it's way more.
Yeah, it's more
like IFTTT,
exactly.
In the sense that like you can kind of wire things together. It looks like they have a little DSL for it too, which is cute.
Yeah, it's basically, that's a better way to describe it. It's I've heard people call it IFTTT. I don't know how to say it. IFTTT. You said right.
If this then that.
Yeah. I actually just use Zapier, but if this and that. I've used that a long time ago. But yeah, it's basically just Zapier or if this and that for GitHub.
Cool. This looks cool.
So that's what I'm thinking is a future. It will be just VS Code embedded in GitHub in the online editor because people are already doing that. What's that one company? Code Sandbox. It's almost like VS Code. Well, I mean, VS Code is just built on top of Monaco by Microsoft. So basically, Code Sandbox is like Monaco. It's like running Monaco, but it also supports like VS Code settings and stuff like that. So you could almost paste your JSON file into codesandbox.io and have your minus a bunch of plugins and crap.
And just like every editor that's been released since TextMate will probably support TextMate syntax highlighting files.
Exactly. Well, yeah, it just supports whatever Monaco does, which is what VS Code is. It's almost basically VS Code in the browser. So I think that's just going to, I mean, Microsoft owns VS Code. Microsoft owns GitHub. So I think that VS Code will just be in GitHub and we'll just use Actions to do our stuff. And that'll be that. But we'll see what happens. But yeah. What do you all think about that? Do you think we'll be breaking the fourth wall here? Do you all think that
we'll be talking to
them? They.
It's just me and you, dude.
Oh, what do you think?
There's no one else in the call.
What is. Yeah, I'm interested to hear what people think about my prediction there, where we'll just all be using GitHub eventually for everything. Feel free to at me, and I will respond.
Yeah, and you can at Sean, since he didn't mention it, at Sean Washbot on Twitter. DNC Show is our Twitter account, and my personal account is Shruckwell.
Yeah, and we have our show notes. I've been taking notes here this whole time. Nobody knew, I bet. They couldn't hear me typing. And you can find those show notes at dnc.show.
Yeah, we also have the show notes over at spectrum.chat, where we're hanging out and can have real-time discussions about the episodes if you want to reach us over there.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a new job, you should head on over to spec.fm/jobs, as I type that right now. I'm checking to see what we've got. We've got, looks like Reactors, looking for a lead product designer. Got some more product designers from Envision. We've got a Datadog is looking for a software engineer. That'd be a really cool gig if you haven't checked out.
Shout out Datadog.
Yeah, Datadog's awesome. So if you're looking for a new gig, head on over to spec.fm/jobs and check them out. And as always, thanks to Spec for having us. They've taken really good care of us over care of me over the years, and they're taking care of you now over the last few months, Rockwell. And if you're not aware, they have a bunch of other shows related to design and development. So if you haven't gone to spec.fm and checked out any of those shows, I highly encourage you to do so.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff over there. This episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson of Spec. All right, happy Black Friday and happy Thanksgiving to you, Sean.
All right, yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you. And I'm thankful for you and everybody that listens to the show. I can't believe I didn't say that before.
That's okay. I'm thankful for our listeners who keep inexplicably coming back.
Yeah, that's right. I've made a lot of really cool friends from the show.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty cool thing to say. I mean, like friends that like I talk to on a daily basis. So that's, I don't know, that's really cool for me because I'm pretty introverted most of the time. So I'm very thankful for everyone that has hit us up and, you know, just had a conversation with me over the few years. So thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And I will see you next week, Sean.
See ya.
Thanks again to Datadog for sponsoring this week's episode. Datadog is simply the best performance analytics solution for your application. Empower your team with powerful trace filtering, deeply integrated metrics, and a beautiful dashboard. And it'll be easier than ever before to identify, analyze, and resolve performance issues that plague your application. You can start a free trial today at datadog.com/doesnotcompute, and Datadog will send you a free t-shirt. Again, a free trial of Datadog is available at datadog.com/doesnotcompute.